come in here sporting a shiner. I did my best to brush it off with administrative punishment, and the young fool wouldn't let it well enough alone. But I never thought he would be crazy enough to blurt it out that he'd hung one on you. He's stupid. You should have eased him out of the outfit weeks ago, instead of nursing him along until he got into trouble. But blurt it out he did, to me, in front of witnesses, forcing me to take official notice of it. And that licked us. No way to get it off the record, no way to avoid a court. Just go through the whole dreary mess and take our medicine, and wind up with one more civilian who'll be against us the rest of his days. Because he has to be flogged. Neither you nor I can take it for him, even though the fault is ours. Because the regiment has to see what happens when 9080 is violated. Our fault, but his lumps. My fault, Captain. That's why I want to be transferred. Sir, I think it's best for the outfit. You do, eh? But I decide what's best for the battalion, not you, Sergeant. Charlie, who do you think pulled your name out of the hat, and why? Think back 12 years. You were a corporal, remember? Where you were? Here. As you know quite well, Captain, right here on this godforsaken prairie, and I wish I had never come back to it. Don't we all? But it happens to be the most important and the most delicate work in the Army, turning unspanked young cubs into soldiers. Who was the worst unspanked young cub in your section? Zim answered slowly. I wouldn't go so far as to say you were the worst, Captain. You wouldn't, eh? But you'd have to think hard to name another candidate. I hated your guts, Corporal Zim. Zim sounded surprised and a little hurt. You did, Captain. I didn't hate you. I rather liked you. So? Well, hate is the other luxury an instructor can never afford. We must not hate them. We must not like them. We must teach them. But if you liked me, then... It seemed to me that you had very strange ways of showing it. Do you still like me? Don't answer that. I don't care whether you do or not. Or rather, I don't want to know, whichever it is. Never mind. I despised you then, and I used to dream about ways to get you. But you were always on the bounce and never gave me a chance to buy a 9080 cord of my own. So here I am, thanks to you. Now, to handle your request. You used to have one order that you gave me over and over again when I was a boot. I got so I loathed it almost more than anything else you did or said. Do you remember it? I do, and now I'll give it back to you. Soldier, shut up and soldier. Yes, sir. Don't go yet. This weary mess isn't all loss. Any regiment of boots needs a stern lesson in the meaning of 9080, as we both know. They haven't yet learned to think. They won't read, and they rarely listen. But they can see. And young Hendrick's misfortune may save one of his mates someday from swinging by the neck until he's dead. Dead, dead. But I'm sorry the object lesson had to come from my battalion. And I certainly don't intend to let this battalion supply another one. You get your instructors together and warn them. For about 24 hours, those kids will be in a state of shock, and then they'll turn sullen, and the tension will build. Along about Thursday or Friday, some boy who is about to flunk out anyhow will start thinking over the fact that Hendrick didn't get so very much, not even the number of lashes for drunken driving. And he's going to start brooding that it might be worth it to take a swing at the instructor he hates worst. Sergeant, that blow must never land, understand me? Yes, sir. I want them to be 8 times as cautious as they have been. I want them to keep their distance. I want them to have eyes in the backs of their heads. I want them to be as alert as a mouse at a cat show. Bronski, you have a special word with Bronski. He has a tendency to fraternize. I'll straighten Bronski out, sir. See that you do. Because when the next kid starts swinging, it's got to be stop-punched, not muffed, like today. The boy has got to be knocked cold, and the instructor must do so without ever being touched himself. Or I'll damn well break him for incompetence. Let them know that. They've got to teach those kids that it's not merely expensive, but impossible, to violate 9080. That even trying it wins a short nap, a bucket of water in the face, and a very sore jaw, and nothing else. Yes, sir. It'll be done. It had better be done. I will not only break the instructor who slips, I will personally take him way out on the prairie and give him lumps, because I will not have another one of my boys strung up to that whipping post through sloppiness on the part of his teachers. Dismissed. Yes, sir. Good afternoon, Captain. What's good about it, Charlie? Yes, sir. If you're not busy this evening, why don't you bring your soft shoes and your pads over to the officers' row, and we'll go waltzing Matilda. Say, 8 o'clock? Yes, sir. That's not an order, it's an invitation. If you really are slowing down, maybe I'll be able to kick your shoulder blades off. Would the captain care to put a small bet on that? Huh? With me sitting here at this desk, getting swivel chair spread? I will not. Not unless you agree to fight with one foot in a bucket of cement. Seriously, Charlie. We've had a miserable day, and it's going to be worse before it gets better. If you and I work up a good sweat and swap a few lumps, maybe we'll be able to get sleep tonight, despite all of Mother's little darlings. I'll be there, Captain. Don't eat too much dinner. I need to work off a couple of matters myself. I'm not going to dinner. I'm going to sit right here and sweat out this quarterly report, which the regimental commander is graciously pleased to see right after his dinner. And which somebody, whose name I won't mention, has put me 2 hours behind on. So I may be a few minutes late for our waltz. Go away now, Charlie, and don't bother me. See you later. Sergeant Zim left so abruptly that I barely had time to lean over and tie my shoe and thereby be out of sight behind the file case as he passed through the outer office. Captain Frankel was already shouting, "Orderly! Orderly! Orderly! Do I have to call you 3 times? What's your name? Put yourself down for an hour's extra duty, full kit. Find the company commanders of E, F, and G. My compliments, and I'll be pleased to see them before the parade. Then bounce over to my tent and fetch me a clean dress uniform. Cap, sidearms, shoes, ribbons, no medals. Lay it out for me here. Then make afternoon sick call. If you can scratch with that arm, as I've seen you doing, your shoulder can't be too sore. You've got 13 minutes until sick call. On the bounce, soldier." I made it by catching 2 of them in the senior instructor's shower. An orderly can go anywhere. And the third at his desk. The orders you get aren't impossible. They merely seem so, because they nearly are. I was laying at Captain Frankel's uniform for parade as sick call sounded. Without looking up, he growled, "Belay that extra duty, dismissed." So I got home just in time to catch extra duty for uniform untidy, 2 particulars, and see the sickening end of Ted Hendricks' time in the MI. So I had plenty to think about as I lay awake that night. I had known that Sergeant Zim worked hard, but it had never occurred to me that he could possibly be other than completely and smugly self-satisfied with what he did. He looked so smug, so self-assured, so at peace with the world and with himself. The idea that this invincible robot could feel that he had failed, could feel so deeply and personally disgraced that he wanted to run away, hide his face among strangers, and offer the excuse that his leaving would be best for the outfit. Shook me up as much, and in a way even more, than seeing Ted flogged. To have Captain Frankel agree with him, as to the seriousness of the failure, I mean, and then rub his nose in it, chew him out. Well, I mean, really? Sergeants don't get chewed out. Sergeants do the chewing. A law of nature. But I had to admit that what Sergeant Zim had taken and swallowed was so completely humiliating and withering as to make the worst I had ever heard or overheard from a sergeant sound like a love song. And yet, the captain hadn't even raised his voice. The whole incident was so preposterously unlikely that I was never even tempted to mention it to anyone else. And Captain Frankel himself, officers we don't see very often, they showed up for the evening parade, sauntering over at the last moment and doing nothing that would work up a sweat. They inspected once a week, making private comments to sergeants, comments that invariably meant grief for somebody else, not them. And they decided each week what company had won the honor of guarding the regimental colors. Aside from that, they popped up occasionally on surprise inspections, creased, immaculate, remote, and smelling faintly of cologne, and went away again. Oh, one or more of them did always accompany us on route marches. And twice Captain Frankel had demonstrated his virtuosity at La Savate. But officers didn't work, not real work, and they had no worries because sergeants were under them, not over them. But it appeared that Captain Frankel worked so hard that he skipped meals, was kept so busy with something or other that he complained of lack of exercise, and would waste his own free time just to work up a sweat. As for worries, he had honestly seemed to be even more upset at what had happened to Hendrick than Zim had been. And yet he hadn't even known Hendrick by sight. He had been forced to ask his name. I had an unsettling feeling that I had been completely mistaken as to the very nature of the world I was in, as if every part of it was something wildly different from what it appeared to be. Like discovering that your own mother isn't anyone you've ever seen before, but a stranger in a rubber mask. But I was sure of one thing. I didn't even want to find out what the MI really was. If it was so tough that even the gods that be, sergeants and officers, were made unhappy by it, it was certainly too tough for Johnny. How could you keep from making mistakes in an outfit you didn't understand? I didn't want to swing by my neck until I was dead, dead, dead. I didn't even want to risk being flogged, even though the doctor stands by to make certain that it doesn't do you any permanent injury. Nobody in our family had ever been flogged, except paddlings in school, of course, which isn't at all the same thing. There were no criminals in our family on either side, none who had even been accused of crime. We were a proud family. The only thing we lacked was citizenship, and Father regarded that as no real honor, a vain and useless thing. But if I were flogged, well, he'd probably have a stroke. And yet Hendrick hadn't done anything that I hadn't thought about doing 1,000 times. Why hadn't I? Timid, I guess. I knew that those instructors, any of them, could beat the tar out of me. So I'd buttoned my lip and hadn't tried it. No guts, Johnny. At least Ted Hendrick had had guts. I didn't have. And a man with no guts has no business in the army in the first place. Besides that, Captain Frankel hadn't even considered it to be Ted's fault. Even if I didn't buy a 9080 through lack of guts, what day would I do something other than a 9080, something not my fault, and wind up slumped against the whipping post anyhow? Time to get out, Johnny, while you're still ahead. My mother's letter simply confirmed my decision. I had been able to harden my heart to my parents as long as they were refusing me. But when they softened, I couldn't stand it. Or when Mother softened, at least. She had written, But I am afraid I must tell you that your poor father will still not permit your name to be mentioned. But, dearest, that is his way of grieving, since he cannot cry. You must understand, my darling boy, that he loves you more than life itself, more than he does me, and that you have hurt him very deeply. He tells the world that you are a grown man, capable of making your own decisions, and that he is proud of you. But that is his own pride speaking, the bitter hurt of a proud man who has been wounded deep in his heart by one he loves best. You must understand, Juanito, that he does not speak of you and has not written to you because he cannot, not yet, not till his grief becomes bearable. When it has, I will know it, and then I will intercede for you, and we will all be together again. Myself, how could anything her baby boy does anger his mother? You can hurt me, but you cannot make me love you the less. Wherever you are, whatever you choose to do, you are always my little boy who bangs his knee and comes running to my lap for comfort. My lap has shrunk, or perhaps you have grown, though I have never believed it. But nonetheless, I will always be waiting when you need it. Little boys never get over needing their mother's laps, do they, darling? I hope not. I hope that you will write and tell me so. But I must add that, in view of our terribly long time that you have not written, it is probably best, until I let you know otherwise, for you to write to me, care of your Aunt Eleonora. She will pass it on to me at once, and without causing any more upset. You understand? 1,000 kisses to my baby, your mother. I understood all right. If father could not cry, I could, and did. And at the last I got to sleep, and was awakened at once by an alert. We bounced out to the bombing range, the whole regiment, and ran through a simulated exercise without ammo. We were wearing full unarmored kit otherwise, including earplug receivers, and we had no more than extended when the word came to freeze. We held that freeze for at least an hour, and I mean we held it, barely breathing. A mouse tiptoeing past would have sounded noisy. Something did go past and ran right over me. A coyote, I think. I never twitched. We got awfully cold holding that freeze, but I didn't care. I knew it was my last. I didn't even hear reveille the next morning. For the first time in weeks, I had to be whacked out of my sack and barely made formation for morning jerks. There was no point in trying to resign before breakfast, anyhow, since I had to see Zim as the first step. But he wasn't at breakfast. I did ask Bronsky's permission to see the CC, and he said, "Sure, help yourself," and didn't ask me why. But you can't see a man who isn't there. We started a route march after breakfast, and I still hadn't laid eyes on him. It was out and back, with lunch fetched out to us by copter, an unexpected luxury, since failure to issue field rations before marching usually meant practice starvation except for whatever you had cached. And I hadn't. Too much on my mind. Sergeant Zim came out with the rations, and he held mail call in the field, which was not an unexpected luxury. I'll say this for the MI. They might chop off your food, water, sleep, or anything else without warning, but they never held up a person's mail a minute longer than circumstances required. That was yours, and they got it to you by the first transportation available, and you could read it at your earliest break, even on maneuvers. This hadn't been too important for me, as, aside from a couple of letters from Carl, I hadn't anything but junk mail until Mother wrote to me. I didn't even gather around when Zim handed it out. I figured now on not speaking to him until he got in. No point in giving him a reason to notice me until we were actually in reach of headquarters. So I was surprised when he called my name and held up a letter. I bounced over and took it, and was surprised again. It was from Mr. Dubois, my high school instructor in history and moral philosophy. I would sooner have expected a letter from Santa Claus. Then, when I read it, it still seemed like a mistake. I had to check the address and the return address to convince myself that he had written it and had meant it for me. My dear boy, I would have written to you much sooner to express my delight and my pride in learning that you had not only volunteered to serve, but also had chosen my own service. But not to express surprise. It is what I expected of you. Except, possibly, the additional and very personal bonus that you chose the MI. This is the sort of consummation, which does not happen too often, that nevertheless makes all of a teacher's efforts worthwhile. We necessarily sift a great many pebbles, much sand, for each nugget, but the nuggets are the reward. By now, the reason I did not write at once is obvious to you. Many young men, not necessarily through any reprehensible fault, are dropped during recruit training. I have waited, I have kept in touch through my own connections, until you had sweated it out past the hump. How well we all know that hump. And were certain, barring accidents or illness, of completing your training and your term. You are now going through the hardest part of your service. Not the hardest physically, though physical hardship will never trouble you again. You now have its measure. But the hardest spiritually. The deep, soul-turning readjustments and reevaluations necessary to metamorphize a potential citizen into one in being. Or rather, I should say, you have already gone through the hardest part, despite all the tribulations you still have ahead of you, and all the hurdles, each higher than the last, which you still must clear. But it is that hump that counts, and knowing you, lad, I know I have waited long enough to be sure that you are past your hump, or you would have been home by now. When you reached that spiritual mountaintop, you felt something, a new something. Perhaps you haven't words for it. I know I didn't when I was a boot. So perhaps you will permit an older comrade to lend you the words, since it often helps to have discreet words. Simply this. The noblest fate that a man can endure is to place his own mortal body between his loved home and the war's desolation. The words are not mine, of course, as you will recognize. Basic truths cannot change, and once a man of insight expresses one of them, it is never necessary, no matter how much the world changes, to reformulate them. This is an immutable, true, everywhere, throughout all time, for all men and all nations. Let me hear from you, please, if you can spare an old man some of your precious sack time to write an occasional letter, and if you should happen to run across any of my former mates, give them my warmest greetings. Good luck, trooper. You've made me proud. Jean V. Dubois, Lieutenant Colonel, M.I., retired. The signature was as amazing as the letter itself. Old Sourmouth was a short colonel? Why, our regional commander was only a major. Dubois had never used any sort of rank around school. We had supposed, if we thought about it at all, that he must have been a corporal or some such who had been let out when he lost his hand and had been fixed up with a soft job teaching a course that didn't have to be passed or even taught, just audited. Of course, we had known that he was a veteran, since history and moral philosophy must be taught by a citizen. But an M.I.? He didn't look it. Prissy, faintly scornful, a dancing master type. Not one of us apes. But that was the way he had signed himself. I spent the whole long hike back to camp thinking about that amazing letter. It didn't sound in the least like anything he had ever said in class. Oh, I didn't mean to contradict anything he had told us in class. It was just entirely different in tone. Since when does a short colonel call a recruit private comrade? When he was playing Mr. Dubois and I was one of the kids who had to take his course, he hardly seemed to see me, except once, when he got me sore by implying that I had too much money and not enough sense. So my old man could have bought the school and given it to me for Christmas. Is that a crime? It was none of his business. He had been droning along about value, comparing the Marxist theory with the orthodox use theory. Mr. Dubois had said, "Of course, the Marxian definition of value is ridiculous. All the work one cares to add will not turn a mud pie into an apple tart. It remains a mud pie. Value, zero. By corollary, unskillful work can easily subtract value. An untalented cook can turn wholesome dough and fresh green apples, valuable already, into an inedible mess. Value zero. Conversely, a great chef can fashion of those same materials a confection of greater value than the commonplace apple tart, with no more effort than an ordinary cook uses to prepare an ordinary sweet. These kitchen illustrations demolish the Marxian theory of value, the fallacy from which the entire magnificent fraud of communism derives, and illustrate the truth of the common sense definition as measured in terms of use." Dubois had waved his stump at us. "Nevertheless, wake up back there." Nevertheless, the disheveled old mystic of Das Kapital, turgid, tortured, confused, and neurotic, unscientific, illogical, this pompous fraud Karl Marx, nevertheless, had a glimmering of a very important truth. If he had possessed an analytical mind, he might have formulated the first adequate definition of value, and this planet might have been saved endless grief. "Or might not," he added. "You!" I sat up with a jerk. "If you can't listen, perhaps you can tell the class whether value is a relative or an absolute." I had been listening. I just didn't see any reason not to listen with eyes closed and spine relaxed. But his question caught me out. I hadn't read that day's assignment. "An absolute," I answered, guessing. "Wrong," he said coldly. "Value has no meaning other than in relation to living beings. The value of a thing is always relative to a particular person, is completely personal and different in quantity for each living human. Market value is a fiction, merely a rough guess at the average of personal values, all of which must be quantitatively different, or trade would be impossible." I wonder what Father would have said if he had heard market value called a fiction. Snort in disgust, probably. "This very personal relationship, value, has two factors for a human being. First, what can he do with the thing, its use for him? And second, what he must do to get it, its cost to him. There is an old song which asserts, 'The best things in life are free.' Not true. Utterly false. This was the tragic fallacy which brought on the decadence and collapse of the democracies of the 20th century. Those noble experiments failed because the people had been led to believe that they could simply vote for whatever they wanted, and get it without toil, without sweat, without tears. Nothing of value is free. Even the breath of life is purchased at birth only through gasping effort and pain." He had still been looking at me, and added, "If you boys and girls had to sweat for your toys the way a newly born baby has to struggle to live, you would be happier, and much richer. As it is with some of you, I pity the poverty of your wealth. You, I've just awarded you the prize for the 100-meter dash. Does it make you happy?" I suppose it would." "No dodging, please. You have the prize. Here, I'll write it out. Grand prize for the championship, 100-meter sprint." And he had actually come back to my seat and pinned it on my chest. "There, are you happy? You value it, or don't you?" I was sore. First that dirty crack about rich kids, a typical sneer of those who haven't got it, and now this farce. I ripped it off and chucked it at him. Mr. Dubois had looked surprised. "It doesn't make you happy? You know darn well I placed fourth. Exactly. The prize for first place is worthless to you because you haven't earned it. But you enjoy a modest satisfaction in placing fourth. You earned it. I trust that some of the somnambulists here understood that little morality play. I fancy that the poet who wrote that song meant to imply that the best things in life must be purchased other than with money, which is true. Just as the literal meaning of his words is false. The best things in life are beyond money. Their price is agony and sweat and devotion. And the price demanded for the most precious of all things in life is life itself. Ultimate cost? For perfect value. I mulled over things I had heard Mr. Dubois, Colonel Dubois, say, as well as his extraordinary letter, while we went swinging back toward camp. Then I stopped thinking because the band dropped back near our position in column and we sang for a while. A French group. Marseillaise, of course, and Madelon, and Sons of Toil and Danger. And then Liaison à Trajère, and the Mademoiselle from Armentières. It's nice to have the band play. It picks you right up when your tail is dragging the prairie. We hadn't had anything but canned music at first, and that only for parade and calls. But the powers that be had found out early who could play and who couldn't. Instruments were provided, and a regimental band was organized, all our own. Even the director and the drum major were boots. It didn't mean that they got out of anything. Oh, no. It just meant they were allowed and encouraged to do it on their own time, practicing evenings and Sundays and such. And that they got to strut and countermarch and show off at parade instead of being in ranks with their platoon. A lot of things that we did were run that way. Our chaplain, for example, was a boot. He was older than most of us and had been ordained in some obscure little sect I had never heard of. But he put a lot of passion into his preaching, whether his theology was orthodox or not, don't ask me. And he was certainly in a position to understand the problems of a recruit. And the singing was fun. Besides, there was nowhere else to go on Sunday morning between morning police and lunch. The band suffered a lot of attrition, but somehow they always kept going. The camp owned four sets of pipes and some Scottish uniforms, donated by Lochiel of Cameron, whose son had been killed there in training. And one of us boots turned out to be a piper. He had learned it in the Scottish Boy Scouts. Pretty soon we had four pipers. Maybe not good, but loud. Pipes seem very odd when you first hear them, and a tiber of practicing can set your teeth on edge. It sounds and looks as if he had a cat under his arm, its tail in his mouth and biting it. But they grow on you. The first time our pipers kicked their heels out in front of the band, skirling away at Alamein Dead, my hair stood up so straight it lifted my cap. It gets you. Makes tears. We couldn't take a parade band out on route march, of course, because no special allowances were made for the band. Tubas and bass drums had to stay behind because a boy in the band had to carry a full kit, same as everybody, and could only manage an instrument small enough to add to his load. But the MI has banned instruments which I don't believe anybody else has, such as a little box hardly bigger than a harmonica, an electric gadget which does an amazing job of faking a big horn, and is played the same way. Comes band call when you are headed for the horizon. Each bandsman sheds his kit without stopping. His squad mates split it up. And he trots to the column position of the color company and starts blasting. It helps. The band drifted aft, almost out of earshot, and we stop singing because our own singing drowns out the beat when it's too far away. I suddenly realized I felt good. I tried to think why I did. Because we would be in after a couple of hours and I could resign? No. When I had decided to resign, it had indeed given me a measure of peace, quieted down my awful jitters, and let me go to sleep. But this was something else, and no reason for it that I could see. Then I knew. I had passed my hump. I was over the hump that Colonel Dubois had written about. I actually walked over it and started down, singing easily. The prairie through there was flat as a griddle cake. But just the same, I had been plodding wearily uphill all the way out and about halfway back. Then, at some point, I think it was while we were singing, I had passed the hump, and it was all downhill. My kit felt lighter, and I was no longer worried. When we got in, I didn't speak to Sergeant Zim. I no longer needed to. Instead, he spoke to me, motioned me to him as we fell out. "Yes, sir?" "This is a personal question, so don't answer it unless you feel like it." He stopped, and I wondered if he suspected that I had overheard his chewing out, and shivered. "At mail call today," he said, "you got a letter, I noticed, purely by accident, none of my business. The name on the return address. It's a fairly common name, some places, but this is the personal question you need not answer. By any chance, does the person who wrote that letter have his left hand off at the wrist?" I guess my chin dropped. "How did you know, sir?" "I was nearby when it happened. It is Colonel Dubois, right?" "Yes, sir," I added. "He was my high school instructor in history and moral philosophy." I think that was the only time I ever impressed Sergeant Zim, even faintly. His eyebrows went up an eighth of an inch and his eyes widened slightly. "So, you are extraordinarily fortunate," he added. "When you answer his letter, if you don't mind, you might say that Ship Sergeant Zim sends his respects."
"Yes, sir. Oh, I think maybe he sent you a message, sir."
"What?"
I'm not certain." I took out the letter, just read. "If you should happen to run across any of my former mates, give them my warmest greetings. Is that for you, sir?"
Zim pondered it, his eyes looking through me somewhere else.
Yes, it is. For me, among others. Thanks very much."
Then, suddenly, it was over, and he said briskly, 9 minutes to parade. You still have to shower and change. On the bounce, soldier."
7. The young recruit is silly. He thinks a suicide. He's lost his gutter devil. He hasn't got his pride. But day by day they kicks him, which helps him on a bit, till he finds hisself one morning with a full and proper kit. Getting clear of dirtiness, getting done with mess, getting shut out doing things, rather more or less.
Rudyard Kipling.
I'm not going to talk much more about my boot training. Mostly it was simple work, but I was squared away, enough said. But I do want to mention a little about powered suits, partly because I was fascinated by them, and also because that was what led me into trouble. No complaints. I rated what I got. An MI lives by his suit the way a canine man lives by and with and on his doggy partner. Powered armor is one half the reason we call ourselves mobile infantry instead of just infantry. The other half are the spaceships that drop us and the capsules we drop in. Our suits give us better eyes, better ears, stronger backs, to carry heavier weapons and more ammo, better legs, more intelligence. Intelligence in the military meaning. A man in a suit can be just as stupid as anybody else, only he had better not be. More firepower, greater endurance, less vulnerability. A suit isn't a space suit, although it can serve as one. It is not primarily armor, although the Knights of the Round Table were not armored as well as we are. It isn't a tank, but a single MI private can take on a squadron of those things and knock them off unassisted if anybody was silly enough to put tanks against MI. A suit is not a ship, but it can fly. A little.
On the other hand, neither spaceships nor atmosphere craft can fight against a man in a suit except by saturation bombing of the area he is in. Like burning down a house to get one flee. Contrarywise, we can do many things that no ship, air, submersible, or space, can do. There are a dozen different ways of delivering destruction in impersonal wholesale. Via ships and missiles of one sort or another. Catastrophes so widespread, so unselective, that the war is over because that nation or planet has ceased to exist. What we do is entirely different. We make war as personal as a punch in the nose. We can be selective, applying precisely the required amount of pressure at the specified point at a designated time. We've never been told to go down and kill or capture all left-handed redheads in a particular area, but if they told us to, we can. We will. We are the boys who go to a particular place at H hour, occupy a designated terrain, stand on it, dig the enemy out of their holes, force them then and there to surrender or die. We're the bloody infantry, the doughboy, the duckfoot, the foot soldier who goes where the enemy is and takes him on in person. We've been doing it, with changes in weapons but very little change in our trade, at least since the time 5,000 years ago when the foot sloggers of Sargon the Great forced the Sumerians to cry uncle. Maybe they'll be able to do without us someday. Maybe some mad genius with myopia, a bulging forehead and a cybernetic mind will devise a weapon that can go down a hole, pick out the opposition, and force it to surrender or die, without killing that gang of your own people they've got imprisoned down there. I wouldn't know. I'm not a genius. I'm an MI. In the meantime, until they build a machine to replace us, my mates can handle that job, and I might be some help on it too. Maybe someday they'll get everything nice and tidy, and we'll have that thing we sing about when we ain't a-gonna study war no more. Maybe. Maybe the same day the leopard will take off his spots and get a job as a Jersey cow, too. But again, I wouldn't know. I'm not a professor of cosmopolitics. I'm an MI. When the government sends me, I go. In between, I catch a lot of sack time. But, while they have not yet built a machine to replace us, they've surely thought up some honeys to help us. The suit, in particular. No need to describe what it looks like, since it has been pictured so often. Suited up, you look like a big steel gorilla, armed with gorilla-sized weapons. This may be why a sergeant generally opens his remarks with, "You apes." However, it seems more likely that Caesar's sergeants use the same honorific. But the suits are considerably stronger than a gorilla. If an MI in a suit swapped hugs with the gorilla would be dead, crushed. The MI and the suit wouldn't be mussed. The muscles, the pseudo-musculature, get all the publicity, but it's the control of all that power which merits it. The real genius in the design is that you don't have to control the suit. You just wear it, like your clothes, like skin. Any sort of ship you have to learn to pilot, it takes a long time, a new full set of reflexes, a difficult and artificial way of thinking. Even riding a bicycle demands an acquired skill, very different from walking, whereas a spaceship, oh brother, I wouldn't live that long. Spaceships are for acrobats who are also mathematicians. But a suit, you just wear. 2,000 pounds of it, maybe, in full kit. Yet the very first time you are fitted into one, you can immediately walk, run, jump, lie down, pick up an egg without breaking it. It takes a trifle practice, but anything improves with practice. Dance a jig, if you can dance a jig, that is, without a suit, and jump right over the house next door and come down to a feather landing. The secret lies in negative feedback and amplification. Don't ask me to sketch the circuitry of a suit, I can't. But I understand that some very good concert violinists Can't build a violin, either. I can do field maintenance and field repairs and check off the 347 items from cold to ready to wear, and that's all a dumb MI is expected to do. But if my suit gets really sick, I call the doctor, a doctor of science, electromechanical engineering, who is a staff naval officer, usually a lieutenant, read captain for our ranks, and is part of the ship's company of the troop transport, or who is reluctantly assigned to a regimental headquarters at Camp Curie, a fate worse than death to a Navy man. But if you really are interested in the prints and stereos and schematics of a suit's physiology, you can find most of it, the unclassified part, in any fairly large public library. For the small amount that is classified, you must look up a reliable enemy agent. Reliable, I say, because spies are a tricky lot. He's likely to sell you the parts you could get for free from the public library. But here is how it works, minus the diagrams. The inside of the suit is a mass of pressure receptors, hundreds of them. You push with the heel of your hand, the suit feels it, amplifies it, pushes with you to take the pressure off the receptors that gave the order to push. That's confusing, but negative feedback is always a confusing idea the first time, even though your body has been doing it ever since you quit kicking helplessly as a baby. Young children are still learning it. That's why they are clumsy. Adolescents and adults do it without knowing they ever learned it, and a man with Parkinson's disease has damaged his circuits for it. The suit has feedback which causes it to match any motion you make, exactly, but with great force. Controlled force. Force controlled without your having to think about it. You jump, that heavy suit jumps, but higher than you can jump in your skin. Jump really hard and the suit's jets cut in, amplifying what the suit's leg muscles did, giving you a 3-jet shove. The axis of pressure of which passes through your center of mass. So you jump over that house next door, which makes you come down as fast as you went up, which the suit notes through your proximity and closing gear, a sort of simple-minded radar resembling a proximity fuse, and therefore cuts in the jets again just the right amount to cushion your landing without your having to think about it. And that is the beauty of a powered unit. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to drive it, fly it, con it, operate it. You just wear it, and it takes orders directly from your muscles, and does for you what your muscles are trying to do. This leaves you with your whole mind free to handle your weapons and notice what is going on around you, which is supremely important to an infantryman who wants to die in bed. If you load a mudfoot down with a lot of gadgets that he has to watch, somebody a lot more simply equipped, say with a stone axe, will sneak up and bash his head in while he's trying to read a vernier. Your eyes and your ears are rigged to help you without cluttering up your attention, too. Say you have 3 audio circuits, common in a marauder suit. The frequency control to maintain tactical security is very complex, at least 2 frequencies for each circuit, both of which are necessary for any signal at all, and each of which wobbles under the control of a cesium clock timed to a microsecond with the other end. But all this is no problem of yours. You want circuit A to your squad leader? You bite down once. For circuit B, bite down twice, and so on. The mic is taped to your throat. The plugs are in your ears and can't be jarred out. Just talk. Besides that, outside mics on each side of your helmet give you binaural hearing for your immediate surroundings, just as if your head were bare. Or you can suppress any noisy neighbors and not miss what your platoon leader is saying simply by turning your head. Since your head is the one part of your body not involved in the pressure receptors controlling the suit's muscles, you use your head, your jaw muscles, your chin, your neck, to switch things for you and thereby leave your hands free to fight. A chin plate handles all visual displays the way the jaw switch handles the audios. All displays are thrown on a mirror in front of your forehead from where the work is actually going on, above and back of your head. All this helmet gear makes you look like a hydrocephalic gorilla, but with luck, the enemy won't live long enough to be offended by your appearance. And it is a very convenient arrangement. You can flip through your several types of radar displays quicker than you can change channels to avoid a commercial. Catch a range and bearing, locate your boss, check your flank man, whatever. If you toss your head like a horse bothered by a fly, your infrared snoopers go up on your forehead. Toss it again, they come down. If you let go of your rocket launcher, the suit snaps it back until you need it again. No point in discussing water nipples, air supply, gyros, etc. The point to all the arrangements is the same, to leave you free to follow your trade. Slaughter. Of course, these things do require practice, and you do practice, until picking the right circuit is as automatic as brushing your teeth, and so on. But simply wearing the suit, moving in it, requires almost no practice. You practice jumping because, while you do it with a completely natural motion, you jump higher, faster, farther, and stay up longer. The last alone calls for a new orientation. Those seconds in the air can be used. Seconds are jewels beyond price in combat. While off the ground in a jump, you can get a range and bearing, pick a target, talk and receive, fire a weapon, reload, decide to jump again without landing, and override your automatics to cut in the jets again. You can do all of these things in one bounce, with practice. But, in general, powered armor doesn't require practice. It simply does it for you, just the way you were doing it, only better. All but one thing. You can't scratch where it itches. If I ever find a suit that will let me scratch between my shoulder blades, I'll marry it. There are three main types of MI armor: Marauder, Command, and Scout. Scout suits are very fast and very long range, but lightly armored. Command suits are heavy on go juice and jump juice, are fast and can jump high. They have three times as much comm and radar gear as the other suits, and a dead reckoning tracker. Inertial. Marauders are for those guys in ranks with a sleepy look. The executioners. As I may have said, I fell in love with powered armor, even though my first crack at it gave me a strained shoulder. Any day thereafter that my section was allowed to practice in suits was a big day for me. The day I goofed, I had simulated sergeant's chevrons as a simulated section leader, and was armed with simulated A-bomb rockets to use in simulated darkness against a simulated enemy. That was the trouble. Everything was simulated, but you are required to behave as if it is all real. We were retreating, advancing toward the rear, I mean, and one of the instructors cut the power on one of my men, by radio control, making him a helpless casualty. Per MI doctrine, I ordered the pickup. Felt rather cocky that I had managed to get the order out before my number two cut out to do it anyhow. Turned to do the next thing I had to do, which was lay down a simulated atomic ruckus to discourage the simulated enemy overtaking us. Our flank was swinging. I was supposed to fire it sort of diagonally, but with the required spacing to protect my own men from the blast, while still putting it in close enough to trouble the bandits. On the bounce, of course. The movement over the terrain and the problem itself had been discussed ahead of time. We were still green. The only variations supposed to be left were in casualties. Doctrine required me to locate exactly, by radar beacon, my own men who could be affected by the blast. But this all had to be done fast, and I wasn't too sharp at reading those little radar displays anyhow. I cheated. Just a touch. Flipped my snoopers up and looked. Bare eyes in broad daylight. I left plenty of room. Shucks, I could see the only man affected half a mile away. and all I had was just a little bitty HE rocket, intended to make a lot of smoke and not much else. So I picked a spot by eye, took the rocket launcher, and let it fly. Then I bounced away, feeling smug. No seconds lost. And had my power cut in the air. This doesn't hurt you. It's a delayed action, executed by your landing. I grounded, and there I stuck, squatting, held upright by gyros but unable to move. You do not, repeat not, move when surrounded by a ton of metal with your power dead. Instead, I cussed to myself. I hadn't thought that they would make me a casualty when I was supposed to be leading the problem. Shucks, and other comments. I should have known that Sergeant Zim would be monitoring the section leader. He bounced over to me, spoke to me privately on the face-to-face. He suggested that I might be able to get a job sweeping floors, since I was too stupid, clumsy, and careless to handle dirty dishes. He discussed my past and probable future and several other things that I did not want to hear about. He ended by saying tonelessly, "How would you like to have Colonel Dubois see what you've done?" Then he left me. I waited there, crouched over, for 2 hours until the drill was over. The suit, which had been feather-light, real seven-league boots, felt like an Iron Maiden. At last he returned to me, restored power, and we bounded together at top speed to BHQ. Captain Frankel said less, but it cut more. Then he paused and added in that flat voice officers use when quoting regulations, "You may deny trial by court-martial, if such be your choice. How say you?" I gulped and said, "No, sir." Until that moment, I hadn't fully realized just how much trouble I was in. Captain Frankel seemed to relax slightly. "Then we'll see what the regimental commander has to say. Sergeant, escort the prisoner." We walked rapidly over to RHQ, and for the first time, I met the regimental commander face to face. And by then, I was sure that I was going to catch a court, no matter what. But I remembered sharply how Ted Hendrick had talked himself into one. I said nothing. Major Malloy said a total of 5 words to me. After hearing Sergeant Zim, he said 3 of them. "Is that correct?" I said, "Yes, sir," which ended my part of it. Major Malloy said to Captain Frankel, "Is there any possibility of salvaging this man?" Captain Frankel answered, "I believe so, sir." Major Malloy said, "Then we'll try administrative punishment." Turned to me and said, 5 lashes. Well, they certainly didn't keep me dangling. 15 minutes later, the doctor had completed checking my heart, and the sergeant of the guard was outfitting me with that special shirt that comes off without having to be pulled over the hands, zippered from the neck down the arms. Assembly for parade had just sounded. I was feeling detached, unreal, which I have learned is one way of being scared right out of your senses. The nightmare hallucination. Zim came into the guard tent just as the call ended. He glanced at the sergeant of the guard, Corporal Jones, and Jones went out. Zim stepped up to me, slipped something into my hand. "Bite on that," he said quietly. "It helps." "I know." It was a rubber mouthpiece, such as we use to avoid broken teeth in hand-to-hand combat drill. Zim left. I put it in my mouth. Then they handcuffed me and marched me out. The order read, "In simulated combat, gross negligence, which would in action have caused the death of a teammate." Then they peeled off my shirt and strung me up. Now here is a very odd thing. A flogging isn't as hard to take as it is to watch. I don't mean it's a picnic. It hurts worse than anything else I've ever had happen to me, and the weights between strokes are worse than the strokes themselves. But the mouthpiece did help, and the only yelp I let out never got past it. Here's the second odd thing. Nobody even mentioned it to me. Not even the other boots. So far as I could see, Zim and the other instructors treated me exactly the same afterwards as they had before. From the instant the doctor painted the marks and told me to go back to duty, it was all